Welcome to Macro Memo, a Board Agenda podcast exploring the impact of macroeconomics and geopolitics on business, with Mark Kennedy, George Ligarias, and hosted by Gavin Hinks. To access thousands of articles, guides, reports, and our upcoming events, sign up or log in at boardagenda.com. That's boardagenda.com. This episode is brought to you by Forvis Mazars, the international audit, tax, and advisory firm helping businesses around the world operate and grow with confidence.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Macro Memo. My name is Gavin Hinks and this is our regular briefing on the macro trends affecting business and trade. There are great developments looming across the macro world with key decisions on the horizon for the European Union, the UK and the United States. Some of it's political, some of it's driven by an increasing sense that something better change, as the Stranglers once put it, and revealing my age, musical preferences. But first, a welcome to our regular macro maestros. We'll start with Mark Kennedy joining us from Dublin. Mark, it's been a while since we last spoke and you've been off on your travels across Europe, I understand.
Indeed, and good to see you, Gavin. Good to see you, George. This is our planning season. We're an August year end as a business, so we tend to be, we do our budgeting and so on earlier in the year, but we start to revisit things and see how's the year shaping up in the first quarter. And so I've been around our, I suppose, heartland as an origin European firm in Paris, London, Dublin, Berlin. And I suppose if there's a takeaway from it, there's a lot of differences as you go around. But if there's a strong takeaway, is the sense of anxiety and maybe nervousness amongst businesses. I think that's driven by, we all knew this was going to be a very political year, and in each of the countries I've mentioned and in others, I suppose there's a lot of volatility there. There's also a sense that governments are not really making headway fast enough against some of the challenges. And we're against a backdrop of a number of years of volatility. I think that's starting to tell a little bit. So that was probably my big takeaway from visiting a few cities in the last month.
Perhaps not the most relaxing month then, traveling around Europe. Joining Mark is our ace economist, George Ligarias, logging in from Athens as always. George, your time away from the podcast was doubtless spent with your head in a book.
Yes, and the book that caught my attention this month was, I knew it, I just never had the chance to pick it off the shelf. It's called Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. So this is a book about negotiating, and it sort of builds on the framework by the Harvard Business Review that, you know, you shouldn't antagonize people and you should view problems as a separate thing to people. But because Chris Voss was an expert negotiator, I think he was an FBI negotiator, it digs in a little bit deeper and it sort of uses emotional zuzitsu to make sure that the other part, you're aware of the other party's feelings. And why is that book important? Because I get the sense that after this election in the US, a whole lot of negotiation is going to take place all over the globe. And I did want to approach this with a more critical eye and see which negotiations have a higher chance of succeeding and which don't.
That's going to be interesting because I imagine we can all imagine someone who really doesn't care about feelings in negotiations in any way whatsoever. So that'll make them extremely interesting after the election.
That is sort of what this book says. And it says that you might not, that particular person might not care about your feelings, but you should care about theirs. And actually, when negotiating with previous presidents, because they do hold all the power, acknowledging their feelings has gotten leaders very far. So that's sort of what this book is negotiating, sort of taming your ego and the grandstanding. Listen to the other person and you're certain to gain an edge on the negotiation.
Well, if things turn out that way, that's going to be sage advice for a lot of national leaders, or could be sage advice for a lot of national leaders in the future. Look, let's turn to our main agenda. We've got some big issues to go over. We're going to look at the Mario Draghi report for the EU, which calls for vast public investment and an accelerated drive for innovation and decarbonisation. We're going to look at the prospects for the UK budget at the end of this month, only days away now, barely more than a week. And lastly, we'll turn, as we've alluded to the US election, but we'll look at the prospects for the world economy post-election. Let's start with Mario Draghi. Last month, he issued a report commissioned by Ursula von der Leyen, in which he laid out the need for a massive increase in investment, 750 to 800 million euros a year, call for a new industrial strategy, greater policy integration, and improved decarbonisation, as I've already mentioned. One thing the report seemed to suggest very, very heavily is that the EU economy is in crisis. George, is it in crisis? And should that give us reason for sleepless nights?
No, it's not in crisis. Definitely nothing to lose sleep over. Look, the EU project has been labeled as sort of doomed ever since the first months of the euro, and definitely after 2011, 2012. And, you know, 12 years later, we're still here. Okay, so it's not in crisis. Is it in decline? Yes. And part of it has to do with Germany losing its industrial edge. Germany was the steam engine of Europe. So we're trying to pick up the slack, and we're trying to do it with debt. This is sort of the problem, right? France is ignoring the stability pact, which underpins the Eurozone, by saying, well, I'm going to run an over 3% deficit until 2029. It's now been put on notice by other countries working to follow, like Italy, Belgium, Slovakia, and Malta. But put on warning means nothing in a group where France is the second biggest player. And Germany is not strong enough to enforce rules, nor is there a supranational instrument that can do that. And the thing that changed since we last spoke is, and it even goes a little bit beyond the scope of the report, is bond vigilantes are out. Now, you know, just to be clear with the podcast listeners, bond vigilantes aren't bond traders that dress up like Batman. Okay, but what's happening is that bond people, for whatever reason, they overestimated potential rate cuts in the US, and now they're shocked to figure out that there might not be as many as they thought. And the markets are especially edgy these days. Okay, so for example, and we're going to talk a little bit more about it, ahead of the budget, Ms. Reeves needs to be extra careful not to say anything that might upset them like it did a couple of years ago. And it's the same thing with the Eurozone. Markets are edgy, so any sort of big plans that come out, you have to take into account how bond markets may react, because the bond market can bring down a country very, very quickly. So there isn't a crisis, but we do have elements that could create a crisis, i.e. a lot of debt, a lot of fiscal incontinence, and the jittery market. So, you know, structural proposals are all well and good, but you really need to play to the markets, lest you cause a crisis on the back of that.
Mark, we don't have any real policy proposals yet or delivery as a result of the Draghi report. But in one sense, when I was going through it, it did sound a little bit like the US Inflation Reduction Act. It aimed to stimulate the economy.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment and a fair comparison. I think maybe before I talk about where we might see policy, I think there's a couple of important points that George has opened out. And they deal somewhat with that bond market question. First of all, is the author has significant credibility here. And I think people will look at his history, you know, and both in his European role and as a government leader in his own country, and see that you've got somebody here who is not a fantasist in any way. He's very pragmatic and he very much understands the markets. So I think you will, there'll be some psychological reflection on that. I think it also, you know, there's a track record there in calling things reasonably right, which I think is important. Second thing I would say is that to the charge of decline, I don't buy it, as you'd have guessed over, you know, from listening to me over the last while. And I certainly don't think the European economy is in a crisis relative to other economies around the world. If we're in a crisis, we're all in a crisis, you know. So I'm putting that, I wouldn't agree with that. But on the decline narrative, one of my questions is always, who says it's a decline? And it tends to be the same cohort of commentators who don't really like the European model. And it's a difficult model, and it's a different model from the unitary state kind of model that are there. And George is right in flagging the kind of inconsistencies in the model. If you're comparing the US to Europe in terms of, you know, a single monetary and so on entity. But a lot of what's in the report actually is good news and positive for those who criticize the model. So I think actually he's been quite clever in that. The other thing I would say before kind of jumping a little bit into policy, and I won't go too far, and we can expand the conversation, but is this is not the only response. And while there's been a lot of commentary about the Draghi report, there's also a second report which preceded it a number of weeks ago, which is called the Letta report, again by an Italian former minister. And it is all about the changes to the internal market. And I think you need to look at the two together. And actually, I have a view that if you take those plus von der Leyen's recommitment to the Green New Deal, I think what you see is what the Europeans are actually very, very good at, which is standing back, reflecting on a complex situation and saying, here's the long-term solution. Now, the big million-dollar question is how in our rather complex interrelationship between individual countries, again, which George points out, and the European institutions, do you execute over a period? And I think that's the million-dollar question in terms of these reports, rather than the diagnosis is bad or the direction is bad. And as you said, look, I mean, there's not a lot of policies in a report like that. There are a couple of, I think, leading points. One is he's calling out very clearly the public and private nature of investment required. And you can see he's estimated, I think, an investment per annum of about 800 billion, which puts you into kind of historical new deals. You know, you're into that kind of, it's a major, major stimulus program for the European economy. But he is pointing out very clearly some of the structural issues and the need to bring private investment in. So I think you'll see policies around. On the innovation side, there's a proposal there for an advanced research project agency, really to drive the innovation agenda and recognizing we are behind the curve as a continent in the fourth industrial revolution, digital and AI and so on. A lot of private initiatives suggested, whether it's around business angels or reforming pension regs to try and bring more private money into investment. And a simplification generally of regulation is something he's calling for, but also R&D regulation and how you improve that. And I think that, you know, he's got different categories, we won't go through them all, but take his comments around finance, again, similar. Simplify regulation, look at ways of leveraging both public and private. And on the decarbonization piece, which is central, obviously, to the last commission and this commission, I think, again, what you're hearing is very proactive business views rather than an idealistic view of climate change. It's very much about how do you bring reforms to the market? How do you deliver those benefits to consumers and businesses critically? How do you bring support for accelerating Europe's position in terms of clean tech and EVs? So it's quite pragmatic, I think, what he's saying. Now, million-dollar question is how will the Commission execute with the governments hand in hand? And I think that's where you get into German politics and French politics and UK politics as a bystander. And the UK is relevant. I wouldn't forget that. UK is part of that wider community, even if it's not part of the plan from an EU perspective.
Well, let me come to German politics because they're quite interesting in this area. One of the first things that's happened is that key figures in Germany have criticised the funding model, haven't they, George, the common borrowing idea. Perhaps you could just explain that very briefly and why why it could turn out to be a problem, or at least a difficult obstacle to overcome?
Well, assuming the proposals are sound and assuming that they all agree, still the question is, where will the money come from? And more than that, at what rate? Because that also seems to be dropping off the radar. You know, interest rates are much higher than they used to. We're not talking about zero rate interest rates. So somebody will have to lend circa 800 billion to the EU, which the EU, according to Mr. Draghi, must commit in unison to repay as a group. Okay, so first of all, there are the Maastricht Treaty barriers, which, if we're being honest, I think the Maastricht Treaty is outdated, and we're all trying to, you know, to work around it, but there needs to be an update to this treaty that will allow for common borrowing, because the treaty itself does not. So we keep, since 2011, we keep trying to figure out ways around it. Mark called Mr. Draghi as a very respectable European individual. He is that, but he's probably also the world's best gambler. In the sense that in 2011 or 2012, since 2011, he gave that famous speech, "We will do whatever it takes to save the euro, and trust me, that will be enough." I'm not using the term gambler lightly. The ECB thereafter printed nearly 7 trillion worth of money to throw in the markets, nearly as much as the Fed. And we know from Tim Geithner's memoirs that he did this without ever consulting Germany. He just went out there and he saw the market reaction. When Angela Merkel saw the market reaction, she just stayed quiet and didn't contradict him. Okay, so the point is, it tactically, possibly the best and biggest gamble in financial history, a 7 trillion worth gamble. Okay, I cannot think of anything like that. But now we're entering the realm of policy, which Mark says is deeper reflection. So there isn't any tacticism there. There is negotiation, and not bilateral, but between 20 countries that have the euro, and as Mark says, possibly a few countries around them which might want to have a say in this. So those negotiations are difficult. Will Europe get there? Here's the thing: as an economist, I don't think it has any other choice. Eventually, that's where things lead us. The downside is, the more you integrate fiscally, the more of banking union you have, the less control you lose over your budget, which means the more you lose your fiscal and eventually your national sovereignty. Okay, and that is something that many Europeans are not ready to give up. So this is the trade-off. And this is where politics will get difficult. But we are, make no mistake, I think, on a one-way street on this. It is a matter of speed. It is a matter of velocity. I think we will eventually get there. Whether this will be, in the next 5 years, 10 years, we need to eventually get there for the euro experiment to succeed.
Mark, that's quite an interesting observation. George is right, isn't he? Surely that there isn't any choice given the competition from the US and other blocs. The work has got to be done. But is the EU capable of doing this at an accelerated pace? Because as George points out, there's a lot of groundwork to do before any of that big funding idea can become reality.
I think the EU is capable. And I think and I respect George's view about, he's right, at a national politics level, there's always a challenge there. But I think there's three things that tell you that the EU is capable. First of all, look at the reaction to the GFC. We have since then put into place a unified support system for European banking, which countries, governments, and populations have bought into. And it's very, very significant, and it would put a very significant call on any country that's part of the system if a bank was to fail in Europe. I mean, that was unthinkable prior to 2008. So it shows that you can actually do things with relative, in a very European way. It wasn't a big fuss. It was built kind of step by step and happened, and a lot of negotiations in, let's say, departments of finance amongst experts rather than in the public debate in the realm of media and so on. You know, not as getting the same thing. I think the second thing you would say is, or that you might reference, is that the context has changed dramatically in the last 5-6 years. And there are two things now which I think drive everybody in Europe to thinking that more integration is better in those areas that matter. I'm not talking about a political umbrella and it's all its aspects that one might imagine, but in areas where we need to work together. And those two elements are security, which is a big element of the report as well. And I think common funding is something that is called out there and is part of that 800 billion. And I think countries, particularly in the eastern borders of the European Union, but generally, even in a country that feels a bit remote like Ireland, this is a much higher on the agenda and much more openness now than it was 5 years ago too. Thinking about shared funding and shared solutions there. And again, he's been very pragmatic in terms of what he's talking about, which is improving the support of the industry and the integration of the industry rather than some sort of big political kind of gesture. Second is climate change. And any paper you pick up, certainly in this part of the world, it tells you that the stats are worse than we even imagined. And the position is worse and people are beginning to suffer really, really badly. And insurance companies are openly talking about the challenges that that's bringing, where they were hinting at it 2 years ago. It's now very much on the agenda and costing billions. So again, I think your man in the street is going to react better. And this again is a key part of the plan. So I think you've got conditions and context that are favorable. The last thing I would say is that, it's a staggering number when you look at it. And 7 trillion is a staggering number when you call it out like that. And I think George made an important point. Well, the Europeans did that, yes. The Americans did it even more. And, if you look at what's happening in China, there's quite a lot of that happening too. So we're not unique. Yeah. And that's my point about it's a global issue that we face at the moment. But we are certainly the core member states. If I go back to not the original coal and steel, but back to, the expansion that happened in the 80s and 90s. Those countries have been sharing a very significant portion of their GDP for 35 years at this stage. And they've been sharing it through structural funds and they've been sharing it through the agreed budget, which is always political and always challenging. So there's a kind of an institutional memory of how to make this work, which is the third reason I think I'm optimistic that we can make this work over a period. Because at the end of the day, he's talking about 5% of GDP, of European GDP. That's what's on the table, So I think I'm more confident perhaps than George than that can be delivered.
Well, that's good to hear. And we'll finish that one on that note of confidence. Let's move on. We've got a UK budget just around the corner, guys. If you read the press, it seems like an impossible task for the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves. She's got to repair public services, stimulate the economy, fill in budget black holes, convince everyone that her fiscal rules will hold. George, if I can come to you first, can she pull it off? Can any Chancellor, head of a government's economy, pull off the kind of thing that we're looking at that faces Rachel Reeves?
Can any politician delivering their first budget deliver everything they have promised during the election campaign and, within the space of a few months? And the answer is likely no. And it becomes harder because the fiscal space simply isn't there. Public sector net borrowing has increased. Markets are already vigilant. And the UK now knows that even as a G7 country, it can find itself in the eye of the storm. 2 years ago, this particular bond storm cost the UK a prime minister. And more important and more embarrassingly, Liz Truss became the shortest-lived prime minister in the history of the realm. Okay, bar another one who I think died a few days in office. So the point I'm making is that, as I said, we have extremely jittery bond markets, which definitely raises the level of difficulty. Because on the one hand, you have voters eager to receive what's been promised. And on the other hand, you have bond markets who say, well, you know, where will that all that money come from? Because we're not happy to give it at face value and at very low rates. Okay, so it is an extremely difficult balancing act. I think that no one will be left completely happy, but success will lie in giving as much as she can without fiscally destroying the budget and without causing the wrath of bond vigilantes.
That's really interesting, Mark, isn't it? Rachel Reeves has got to tread extremely cautiously.
Yeah, I think that's true. And look, I think it's true of any chancellor or minister for finance in any major economy at the moment. I mean, it's a volatile background, and there are plenty of actors, whether it's in the market or politically, who are going to be having a go. I think as well, you know, I'm a step removed from UK politics, and I try and keep up on it. But my sense is that this current government is doing two things, or has done two things. One is, if the election, they didn't promise that much. Actually, they actually were quite negative and downbeat. And she's continued that theme and pointed out the big black hole and so on and so forth. So I think she's given herself a certain amount of political leeway to do things that are harder. I think the other thing is they've listened to maybe advisors going back to the last Labour governments, who said, you know, the time to make really hard calls and impose a bit of pain where it's needed is going to be in the first year, not the last year of your mandate. So I think she's given herself a bit of wriggle room, and I think you will see a cautious, but at the same time, I think they're trying to have building blocks in this budget. You know, I think what's interesting for us is as onlookers, is, you know, what's the reaction going to be internationally, as Georgia said, but also what's the reaction for businesses, and what's the reaction for the kind of mindset of consumers? And I think that she's going to have to be careful to manage those conflicting needs, I think, well in the budget.
George, just coming back on that very quickly, what kind of policy decisions do you anticipate?
I think there's probably three things that businesses in particular, if I take that, there's probably four big thoughts I have. We can, you know, go into detail on them, but we can pick them up. First of all is, I think UK businesses are really looking for a budget that supports growth. I think there's a limited amount that any government can do that in that directly. So I think your target there is trying to create, to remove the hassles for business in investing in growth. And so I think you'll see, potentially, hopefully, things around the planning system, things around maybe business rates and so on, that a lot of business communities have been vocal about. I think big thing for me is capital. And I think I mentioned earlier, pension regulations being a key part of the plan in Europe. I think, again, allowing more pension investment capital hit the market and support businesses, I think, and develop businesses is important. On the growth thing, I think net zero is a headache for a lot of businesses, as the regulations have become more in play as businesses have started to report. It's forced directors to think more about, well, what have I got to actually do? The cost landscape is jumping up with them. So I think clean tech, supporting investments, that area is really, really important. And I hope to see some initiatives around there. And the third thing is employment. And, you know, the UK economy is not unique in that inflation has hit certain segments of the population more than others. And that's because inflation tends to kind of be most impactful and have its longest resonance on maybe staples and lower cost goods, which means that the squeezed working people who, you know, maybe were going into the inflationary crisis not feeling terribly well off are coming out of it feeling stuck, and they're still working hard, and they're not seeing the benefit of inflation falling yet. So I think things that can help employers with their employees, whether it's, you know, looking at the apprenticeship levy again, or maybe something, you know, there's a lot of health costs that are now there, supports around that, again, are things that government can do directly to help businesses, which will help their employees, which helps, again, with that overall growth and development agenda. If there was a last thing, moving away from business, I think I'd love to see the Chancellor be careful of the squeezed middle. And that's those people, as I said, who maybe have felt the pain of inflation more. It's also certain categories of people in life stage, you know, with parents that are maybe not well, children that are not out of the nest yet. You know, there's a lot of things to draw on your income. It's an expensive part of life. You've got mortgages and all of that. So I think something that takes a little bit of pressure off them, or at least doesn't add to the pressure, is very important, keeping the national motivation going the right way, because those are your core workforce in many ways.
George, just coming back to you, how do you see Rachel Reeves pushing growth, a growth agenda, because the country really needs that?
Yeah. So the one observation I have is that this is not 1997. And, you know, this is not the new Labour. And Keir Starmer's government has nowhere near as fiscal room or as, you know, political goodwill to implement changes like Tony Blair did. Tony Blair became prime minister after years of, you know, some sort of fiscal conservatism, and this is quite the opposite regime. So there is simply not the space to deliver that much growth, at least not via debt anymore and debt accumulation. Can you deliver growth by making meaningful changes to the market structure? Up to a point. The UK is already a very open economy, so that's not going to come through trade. You know, you can't open it much more than what is right now. It's one of the 8 most open economies in the world. You can't do it by tech because, first of all, the UK, okay, it is one of the global leaders, but really tech leadership is in the US and China mostly. So, you know, you can play around with the rules and you can make a number of smaller changes that may add up to something meaningful. But can you make big decisions that will change the state of play in one fell swoop? I don't think that's even possible,
Mark. So what you're left with is a work in progress. You do difficult things now, and hopefully you're doing more optimistic things, more cheering policy initiatives further down the line. But you're going to take some political heat for it, aren't you?
You are, yeah. And I think that was, I suppose, why I'm maybe a bit laboriously earlier focusing on, I think they've created themselves a bit of space, and yeah, the media is going to be noisy, but I think people will get on with it. And I think the key issue for this government is building a platform for real economic development over the next couple of years. And George is right. This is not going to be a giveaway budget that kind of helps, you know, directly influences growth, but it can be seen to do things which build that platform. And I think so what you'll see is a thoughtful budget. That's what I'm hoping for. I mean, we'll know a lot more in a few weeks.
And that's a key issue for business. Signs that it's heading in the right direction rather than at a destination right now.
Yeah.
Right. Look, we've got a little bit of time left here in this program. Let's turn to the US elections. George, I want to come to you first because it's an intriguing economic and trade position that we are confronted with, depending on how the result goes in November. Economic policy so far has been about rising debt, tariffs, dealing with inflation and interest rates. How do you see things developing after the election, depending on the result, of course?
Look, let's focus on what we know. Both Democrats and Republicans want to run high deficits. Both Democrats and Republicans have no intention to deaccelerate, let alone reduce debt accumulation. Both have a hostile stance against China, although I think people will be surprised to find that a Republican government might be a lot less hostile than they think. Both continue with politics that are internally for the country divisive and which ultimately could cause bigger, longer-term problems. Where they differ Republicans are more unpredictable if they get the White House, and they are more their policies and the at the end of the equation lies significant USD devaluation as a measure of to increase competitiveness. Whereas the Democrats don't seem to want to go there. Democrats want to apparently or ostensibly they want to preserve the international order to keep China in check, whereas Republicans, and that's why I say there might be a surprise, just not one they're ready to admit, they might seem to want to revert to a sphere of influence world which we had right after the World War II. What I'm worried about is a common theme between both, and that is divisiveness. They both seem to be speaking not to the wider audiences, but strictly to their own audiences in the loudest possible voice. Now, both Mark and I come from countries that have been through some sort of internal strife, Ireland and Greece. And the one thing that we have learned is that strife can persist well after the end of actual hostilities. And I think this is very much the case in the US right now. Yes, their civil war ended in 1865, but the divisions are very high. And there are divisions between North and South. There are divisions between social classes. There are divisions between industrialized and less industrialized parts. And I think those divisions have run very high. Are we threatened with a split up of the United States? Possibly not. But I think the larger threat, realistic threat, is an economy that's simply not functioning well because you have one state doing its own thing and its own Supreme Court saying X, and another state doing its own thing and its own Supreme Court saying Y. And the United States Supreme Court putting their hands up and saying, well, okay, you know, it's up to the states to decide, because that seems to be the direction of travel today. Okay. So, this is what worries me, and it's a common theme for both. There doesn't seem to be common ground in politics in the US.
Mark, it's an interesting point for multinationals, at least, doing their risk calculations that involve geopolitics. You know, look at the election and think, hope that stabilizes the politics. But as George points out, in effect, in reality, it may not. You continue to get unstable politics even post-election, which has an impact on trade and economics.
Yeah, you can. And look, the American system, I'm certainly not qualified to comment too much on it, but the American system has very strong institutions, despite the kind of fraying of it that might be suggested in a period of election. So I'm less concerned about that. I think the reality of, you know, George, I was thinking as George was saying, the different divisions that one might look. I mean, we have the same conversation in Europe. I'm sure they have the same conversation in Asia. You know, there's lots of competing interests and there's lots of positions. But I'm overall, I think, you know, the structures that we've built over hundreds of years in different parts of the world will last. So I'm not in quite as negative a space there. I think in terms of a business view, and George, I thought, did a very good analysis in his first couple of minutes where he kind of listed all the similarities and differences. I mean, big picture, there's probably two major things you hear and you think about. One is there is probably a view, and it's marginal, that the Republican economic policy, if carried out to its full, and again, there's a big F in that in the way the system works, may lead to more of a risk of a global recession. And that said, that part of that is context. It's not just about policy, and it's the same context for both sides. So there is a view out there, and maybe it's a particularly European view, that there's a concern about that. And I could see large multinationals kind of thinking about that. What does that mean if there's a bit of a slowdown? What does it mean if there's more inflation as a consequence of some actions? America is the biggest player in the room in all of these things, you know, so it has a disproportionate impact. I think the other thing is, as we saw a few years ago, more geopolitical unrest, which is not necessarily the US's fault, but because it's played such a role in being a settler of difference and trying to make the world a better place from that perspective. If it's a more traditionally retrenched view, and again, taking a long view, America was up to the Second World War and afterwards very much retrenched and was isolationist. If we go back to that kind of perspective, yeah, there's more risk that in a fragmented, difficult world, you're going to have more issues, which again creates issues for multinationals, whether it's supply chain, political risk, or however you're going to put it. So I think they're probably the two things that come out. I go back, again, I'm trying to be optimistic here, or I am optimistic here. I think it was Coolidge said, the business of America is business. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. So I think irrespective of who wins the election, I think that's going to be a theme that we see.
Well, it certainly seems the focus of many politicians over there, in any case. Thanks for the very much for that, guys. We're at the end of our time. Let me very briefly come back to you and ask you, as we normally do at this juncture, whether you're feeling bullish or bearish about the future. George, can I come to you first? How are you feeling, given the discussion we've just had?
Look, equity markets are bullish, so I'm feeling bullish too, to be honest. And, you know, Mark has a point. It is my job, unfortunately. That's why they call economics the dismal science. It is my job to focus on risks. And part of this podcast is doing exactly that. Also, in full knowledge and assurance that Mark is the optimist of the two, and he will lay out the more optimistic case, because it's no fun if two people agree on everything. Overall, and when all is said and done, I am positive, I am bullish, in the sense that I don't see any big systemic risks out there. And I see central banks ready to fight off any systemic risks the moment they arrive. The moment they arise. So, you know, think 2008, for example, right? It took them a few weeks to get through the troubled asset relief plan, and they have to get through the Senate and all that. Now there is a problem. The central bank just fires half a trillion at it. No one bats an eyelid. And that prevents most economic crisis, because most economic crisis, and the fact I did some research in the past few weeks, most economic crisis, bar two in the last 150 years, stem from financial crisis, from instabilities in the financial system. Okay, it is possibly the exception of the pandemic and you know what the problems you had during world wars. Okay, where you might see problems, so that are not endogenous to the financial system. And now I see the financial system, that's something that's pretty much secured by central banks. That means I am bullish, because I think we have a golden bullet to stave off crisis that gives us enough time to react rationally to problems that will inescapably arise. Yes. But we will get through them, because we do have mechanisms to do so. So do I see the problems? Yes, they're all there. You know, do I see solutions? Not always, but what I see is ample time to develop those solutions.
Mark, we've got the structural tools in place to give us cause for being bullish.
Yeah. I'm uncharacteristically a little bit bearish, and I'm bearish in the short term. I think that's what matters. And, you know, I just see the resolution of 2024 and the launch of 25 could be challenging for some businesses. And if I was, as I am, I said, I'd start planning for business for the coming 6 months, I'd be taking a slightly more bearish view of where I think markets are going to be, where business is going to be at, and preparing for that. In the long run, as George says, I tend to be looking for the sunny side. I'm bullish overall. I think we'll get back on track. You know? So that's where my head is at today.
That's good to hear. Very good to hear. That's all from this edition of the Macro Memo. It just remains for me to thank for all of you for downloading or logging in. And thanks to Mark Kennedy and George Ligarius for their expert views. Thank you and goodbye.
Thanks, Gavin.
Thank you.
That was a podcast brought to you by Board Agenda. To get the best in boardroom thinking and access a hub of expert insight, intelligence, and resources for boards and directors, sign up or log in at boardagenda.com. That's boardagenda.com.